you aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch. You must be a witch.
Hello to the Missing Witches Coven. I hope you're safe. I hope you're well. I hope you're being careful. I hope you're keeping magical. I hope you are revering and reveling in your domestic magic. I hope you are writing poems. I hope you are planting seeds. For today's episode of the Missing Witches podcast, I was in conversation with Michelle, the Birch Trail. You heard her on last year's Ostara episode about spiritual bypassing, and we definitely both agreed that the conversation was not finished. So we had been planning an in-person roundtable. Obviously, that didn't happen. So we moved our conversation to an online platform, which meant that we got to include Marisa de la Peña, who was in Los Angeles, in addition to artists Jason and Phoenix, and of course Michelle. I learned so much from this conversation, and I hope you all will too. We love you.
Gwe and WZ Michelle, Takaranto Teleawi, Gato Muniang Guye. So I'm Michelle. I run a jewelry business called The Birch Trail, and I'm also an events organizer with Collective Creative Montreal. That's me.
Thank you, Marisa.
I'm Marisa de la Peña. I'm here in Los Angeles, Occupied Tongva Territory. I am an artist, and I'm also working on a project called Not Your Ancestors.
And we'll definitely be keeping in touch with you on the Not Your Ancestors workbook, and hopefully you'll have lots of news for us on that front coming forth, and keep an eye out, because we will definitely be letting our listeners know when that manifests fully. And how about Jason?
Uvanga Jason Tsiklok. I'm Inuk from Rigolet in Nunatsiavut. Just like to say that though I am Inuit, I cannot and will not speak for other Inuit peoples. My opinions are my own. I said Inuit peoples.
it's like a people, double plural. Peoples.
Oh my God.
I've been colonized.
Do you want to take two, or do you want to leave it?
I can leave it, and you can leave me editing myself.
Leave the laughter. Good. See, because again, like, we're all making mistakes all the time, and so I think it's good that we all acknowledge all of our mistake-making all the time. Some mistakes are a little more brutal than others, but... Phoenix.
Yeah, we've all been colonized, so no worries. I'm Phoenix. I'm a performance artist and a drama therapist. And I'm really interested and like devoted to kind of like reclaiming African, Egyptian spiritualities and cultures and dances, and like protecting indigenous Egyptians too, like, yeah. And connecting North Africans too, and Middle Easterns, even though I hate the word Middle East because it doesn't make any sense. That's me. That's my thing.
And again, thank you all so much. Like, I really can't even express. Oh, I can tell you how I'm expressing it. Risa and I are taking our Patreon contributions for the month of May, and we're forwarding those to the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. So I hope that this act is an appropriate expression of gratitude that I have for all of you for coming and sitting with me here today. So how's everybody doing? What's everybody doing?
I'm barely holding it together, sis.
Well, you look gorgeous. That's got to count for something, right?
It sure does. It counts for everything at this point.
But you're safe. You're secure. You have supplies.
Yes, totally. I'm snacking as we speak.
Good. You know, like, this is such a, like, 21st century. Everybody I know is like, oh, I'm going to get fat during this horrible pandemic. Like, if you're getting fat during a pandemic, then, like, kiss your own ass. Like, so grateful. Like, you'd be grateful for that fat ass. My God.
So true.
Oh, Marissa's here. Marissa's here. Let's let Marisa into the room.
Hey, I'm La Peña. I'm here in Los Angeles, California. I am Chicanx and of Indigenous descent, Yaqui. Hey. but also my focus is on Indigenous and Chicanx, Latinx appropriation in New Age. I'm going to be going to UCSB to get my MFA in fine art this fall 2020. So I'm going to be taking my project, Not Your Ancestors, which does talk about appropriation in New Age, to my MFA program, because it's something that I'm passionate about and I want to talk about, because we need to have these conversations.
Because I saw that the Not Your Ancestors workbook was like a work in progress last time I heard about it. So did it start as a thesis project, or did it kind of evolve into that?
I think it's going to just kind of evolve into many things, because like I think when you confine something into just one thing, it really limits outside voices coming in, and also like, you know, other academics talking about it as well. So I feel like this is like a living document, because I want people to participate. I want it to be, you know, a conversation that I can't just speak for like everybody. Like, that's not right. Like, I need to give the floor to other Indigenous folks, to other Latinx folks, other Chicanx folks, other people of the BIPOC community. Like, because it affects all of our communities in very different ways, but it's just settlers are not showing up like they should be, and this is a call to action. So
I find that, like, I've seen, it seems like First Nations people across the board in all the Americas are doing the heavy lifting. And it's like, we're tweeting and we're posting, ooh, you know, this strong and land back. But what can settlers bring more to the table? Let me be blunt. What are white people specifically doing? No, not doing. What do we need to be bringing to the table that we're not bringing?
Just give us our land back.
So what is that? What does that look like? What does that look like? What does that look like?
That's a big argument though for a lot of our communities. Like, especially like if you read works by like Eve Tuck, like decolonization is not a metaphor. Like, she specifically mentions like rematriarchizing land, giving land back to Indigenous folks is the right step forward. Like, ultimately the goal of decolonizing and unsettling is to give land back. So that is one of the actual like arguments. And like, even though we're kind of like, give us our land back, like we half joke about it, but we're really very much serious about it. honestly, like, I think my main issue right now is that settlers and people who are allies, they get to choose to bow out whenever they want to. Like, they have the privilege of being able to be like, I'm uncomfortable, I'm going to sit this one out. And it's like, we don't get that. We always have to be the ones to handle the nitty gritty and to do the gross work and be the one that's underneath the magnifying glass. Whereas like settlers, they get to bow out. They get to just be like, you know what? I'm uncomfortable, or like, I don't think I can speak out about this. It's like, not that you can speak out about it. It's like, use your privilege to open the floor more, because you're the ones with the power right now. Like, we're really like, we're always having to be on a soapbox. We're always having to, but we don't get a break. We don't get to rest. Settlers get to rest.
Well, take a look at the blockades that happened recently too. Like, oh yes, I support them natives, but like, not when they inconvenience me minorly. Like, now everything's shut down anyways, so Mother Earth had her say in the end.
And these pipelines are now completely out of the news cycle as well.
Yeah, you know, and they're being built.
Yeah.
They're still being built. Unistoten's trying to get the man camp shut down because of the COVID-19 risk that's happening there with no success. It's like not even top in the news anymore. COVID is just so prevalent there that all the fight we had 4 or 5 weeks ago, that's just gone now, even though the country's still shut down.
And even though it's still a COVID risk, like somehow not in the COVID news.
Yeah, man camps were one of the main things that were listed in the MMIWG report as like one of the dangers to our Indigenous women. So it's not only the COVID-19 risk right now, it's doubly bad, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about all of us who live in this privilege 24/7, now having to encounter, you know, the notion of food insecurity for the first time, the notion of any type of insecurity for the first time. But the things that were always happening are not stopping. It's flood season. And these things are going to keep happening despite the fact that some of us are just like feeling these things for the first time. Like I say, food insecurity is something that for a lot of us, and I'm guessing for a lot of the listeners of this podcast, is something that they never contended with before. Not even notionally, not even as an idea. Michelle, I see.
Yeah, it's really funny because in all like the climax that was happening with like the blockades and then, you know, people ripping into like, oh, just going to res and just getting cigarettes and blah, blah, blah. And now that everything's all closed up because of COVID, guess who are all flocking to res to buy cigarettes? Guess who are
happening in the Yukon?
No,
I sent those people back. They were like, leave.
I'm getting there. So it's not just, it's been in like Donawage, it's been in Tananaga, where people are just lining up like crazy. And then a couple in Quebec decided to drive to the Yukon and take a plane to go up to a remote area to try to run away. And when they got there, they realized that there's no fucking food and there's everything is like lacking. And then they got sent back. And it's like, what do you think you're doing? Like going up there to find refuge and potentially like put that community at risk.
But yeah. They didn't get sent back until that community fed them for 2 weeks and took care of them despite their obvious unworthiness of this care. Yeah. And I think that is a very good example of the sort of before COVID reason that we were going to have this conversation. And that's on the appropriation of First Nations culture, of other people's ancestral culture. And like you say, it's all demeaned, it's all demonized until I need something from you or until I want something from you. And
that's a constant narrative though, where it's like, when there's just like, it's just a sense of greed and an inheritance where people, when they're so desperate, they go back to the land because they're like, oh, well, this will save us. And it's like, you have taken so much from us already and now you want to come back to the land. And I remember, I can't remember what post I was seeing, but I was going through people's Instagram posts and they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to go connect back to the land. And the only thing that I can think of is, you think my fucking ancestors are listening to you right now? Do you think that they care about you right now? Because what's going on right now, like collectively, like they have so many other people's prayers that they have to listen to. You think that your prayer is going to get through? Like this is, the land is angry right now. Like it's not going to save you unless you're good to it. And I feel like you have not been good to it at all. And like, especially here in the States, like what's going on, like we had one tribe recently lose their status and like all, like there's just so much shit going on right now. And this is a time when they're attacking Indigenous communities and they're attacking, you know, Black and Indigenous people of color communities. Like and they want to come back to the land and yet this, people are getting their land taken from them.
And they're, this is the first tribe that met the Pilgrims, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of all things. Oh my God.
And then you see what's going on with communities here where we have so many food deserts, we have so many shortages, and people are taking stuff that are WIC foods, which is people who have food stamps here in the United States. They can't even get food because these people are hoarding food. People are going to communities, indigenous communities, and going to their markets and stocking up on food there. And it's like, you guys are really hurting communities that really need stuff like this. Like in my community, there's so many people here who are on food stamps and they can't get anything at the markets. It's disgusting.
And it's evidently, it's like a microcosm for what has always been happening. This is just like the virus has elevated what we were always already doing. It feels like we were always already ignoring people in need for our own gain. And I'm talking about this colonial mentality, of course. When I say we, I don't mean the five of us sitting here, but we in this colonial mentality. That's what we're used to doing. I wanted to ask you, I know that you, Jason, I mean, again, all of you, but you, Jason, specifically, you work with climate justice and you also are a visual artist. So can you talk to me about how your activism and your art intersect with one another?
I think I caught the question.
I know.
You can type it in.
Yeah, I'll say it again. But I'll say it again. Can you talk a little bit about how your visual art and your activism intersect?
Okay. Yeah, for a long time, it was mostly about directly related to colonialism and how the effects of church and entities like the Hudson Bay Company affected our people in the Nazi era. But lately it's been directly related to climate change. I did some writing and
is he frozen or did he just stop talking?
He's frozen.
Okay, we'll carry on and maybe he'll join us. This is going to be a fun episode to edit. Good thing I love editing. So, okay, Michelle, I know that you you had a bug in your bonnet and you wanted to talk about plastic shamanism. So do you want to just jump in?
Oh my gosh.
Let's turn that, crank that wheel.
I'm going to tell the story about how this whole episode came about.
Good.
And it's when last time we had our discussion, it was about spiritual bypassing, but it's like such a light topic and we really need to get into appropriation because there's a lot of the mistakes between like when we spoke about sage and growing sage, like just because you can grow it on your own doesn't mean you should still profit from the ceremony and include it in your witch stuff. That's all I'll say. So just like expanding on this conversation is how that happened. And me and Marisa were actually having a conversation too, because this all intersects, man. This all intersects. And we were talking about how there's no indigenous divination tools. There's nothing done from an indigenous perspective. And in my closet, yeah.
I was just going to say, we can find the images, but they're certainly not being produced by indigenous people. We see a lot of, you know, dream catcher imagery, but it's not being produced within those.
It's not being produced by indigenous people.
Exactly, yes.
So it's all like a big romance, like whatever. Anyway, so like it's all like appropriation, basically. And I went through my closet and I'm like, wait, I have an oracle deck written by an indigenous person. My mom bought it for me. So I go into my closet and then we start doing a little research into it. And I'm like, oh, okay, this person claims like five different indigenous heritages. Their oracle deck is based off of like, I guess, like spirit animals, like, except they call them medicine animals or medicine cards, as the oracle is called. And going further back into it, they didn't have any tribal affiliation. They had an affiliation to something called the Wolf Clan Teaching Lodge, which is an organization in the UK. So,
sorry, I just want to make sure I heard that right. In the United Kingdom?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Carry on. Thank you.
Yes. So, looking into this Wolf Clan Teaching Lodge, apparently these people have teachings from a Seneca elder, except this whole deck had just like stories from multiple nations. So not only is it appropriative, like in that sense, it's also like promoting some pan-indigeneity without actually having contributions from other nations. So that just like flipped me up on my head, like, oh, well, this person seems like they're indigenous, whether or not they have those roots or not, but that's not a reliable source. And I'm like, how? There's so many people that are like coming out like that, where they're like, I'm a healer, I'm a shaman, I got my teachings from XYZ elder, native elder, and now I can profit off of it. Like, no. So now that deck has been mailed to Marisa for the Not Your Ancestors project.
Yeah, I have a whole library, and I was actually going through everything yesterday when I was decluttering in my quarantine time. I have so many decks that people have mailed to me, like so many of these like medicine decks, the medicine cards. I have like 5 of those decks. I have so many of, oh my God, I'm trying to remember because it's the cards that are a circle.
Oh yeah.
I can't remember what they're the name is.
Mother Gaia or something. Isn't it?
Mother Peace. I have so many of the Mother Peace. But these decks are all like super deceptive and just kind of like they put on the air of like there was a certain time, I would say from like the late 70s to like the early 90s when these decks were produced, and people still use them because they're like considered classics. But they are like faux indigenous. They are very appropriative. They're super offensive. A lot of like people of color are whitewashed in them. It's gross. It's super gross. But that trend has kind of morphed into what we have now in New Age, where people are doing spiritual bypassing. And it is just what Eve Tuck coins as a move to settler innocence, is when people try to come up with excuses in order to say why it's okay with the appropriation that they've done. Like, oh, like, well, I really connected with this because I learned this from an elder, or I learned this from a teaching, or I'm, you know, 1/8 Cherokee on my grandmother's side.
I was Native in a past life.
Oh no, stop
that
it.
Well.
I'm not joking.
I've heard before.
Okay, yeah. I'm just going to say this. Listeners, if you're listening to the Missing Witches podcast, no. Marisa, please carry on.
I would say like there's so many amazing academics and educators who are talking about appropriation and identity when it comes to, you know, being a person of color. And I feel like Eve Tuck, her terms are really amazing for that, like a move to settler innocence. And there's different forms of that. You know, it's when people try to, you know, say, well, just because I descend from this doesn't mean I am that. And it's like, we're not saying that you are that. We're saying that you benefit from that history, and that you get to write your own history, and your history is false. So a lot of people like to especially here in the United States, people here like to romanticize like the Old West. They like to romanticize this idea of American history and what American identity is. And it's like, nah, it's built on like blood and theft. And this, you know, on the back of people of color. And it still is that way. Like, we still have not healed as a nation. Like, we are greatly suffering because we don't recognize our history.
We saw cowboys and Indians. That was the theme. And so if the cowboy is the hero, what does that mean?
Yeah. And it's, And it's not just like the narrative with indigeneity in the United States. It's, you know, the narrative for all people of color in the United States. But at the same time too, like the lack of acknowledgement when it comes to what happened to indigenous folks in this country, you know, throughout North America, South America, like the world, like we've gotten like this, the softest apologies for things. And it's like, it doesn't make up for the fact that you don't even acknowledge the truth. And when it comes to the appropriation that you see in New Age, it's also, narratives are also made up as well, because it fits the story better. Nobody wants to sell something that is based off of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, go ahead.
Can you guys hear me on my microphone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yay. I switched devices, so it's a little better now.
Good.
Good. Cool.
But that's what it comes down to, and what Michelle was going toward with the plastic shamanism is that it does, everything has to be sold. You would learn something, and it's not so that you can learn it, whatever you just, it's so you can sell it to the next guy and the next guy.
And focusing it back in onto the spiritual community, because I find like, the modern spiritual community, a lot of it's built off of Wicca and, you know, the Golden Dawn and Gerald. And a lot of that's just like founded on, all of it is heavy in appropriation, and not just indigenous appropriation. Like, we're looking at African appropriation, we're looking at Egyptian appropriation. Like, any person, any young witch entering into the realm of paganism is going to fall on the Greek pantheon and the Egyptian pantheon, and that is usually your gateway. And it's just like, the spiritual community needs to unpack that.
Yeah. And not Phoenix and I have spoken about this in the past, but it's like, when I was growing up, Egypt was one thing and Africa was another thing. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not sure if that was like your educational experience too. It's almost like, go ahead.
Oh, I think Phoenix froze.
Oh, and I was just about to, we were just getting to the Middle East.
I know, right?
Like, I say that when it comes to appropriation of that realm, like none of us are not guilty of it. And I think that we all need to acknowledge that, because it's still something that's very trendy. And I feel like it just kind of like with indigenous appropriation, we see it in everything as well. But like, I'm so guilty of it as well. And I'm so disgusted.
When did you cut out, Phoenix?
When you started talking about the spiritual community.
Okay. Yeah. So I was saying that the spiritual community being founded on Wicca, and we know what Wicca is founded on, and that when a lot of spiritual people enter into paganism, a lot of them are presented with A, the Egyptian pantheon, and B, the Greek pantheon. So we're just kind of like bringing it towards like that, because the appropriation is far beyond like indigenous North American appropriation. It's like wreathed everywhere in Africa. And Amy was just talking about how when we were presented growing up, because we're all, I lost my train of thought.
Americans. Yeah.
Whatever. Anyways, we're all guilty of like appropriation off of these pantheons. And then Amy was saying how when you were learning it, Egypt always is separated from Africa.
Like, yes. Oh my God. This is such a problem I deal with all the time, from within and without Egypt. So yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? How, like I was saying, like, you know, Egypt and Africa, when I was growing up, they were sold as two different things. But if you look at a map, they are, you know, Egypt is in Africa, but it wasn't until, and you know, like, right. But you know, the way it was pitched to me in the 80s when I was growing up was that it was somehow separate.
Yeah, you know. Because I think, I don't know what, when or why, but Europeans got really interested in Egypt and British people based their racial theories and hierarchies like on some bullshit. And they decided that Egypt was part of the white race. because they wanted to claim our civilization, and they wanted to somehow make it so that we were separated from Africans, but because it couldn't be that an African civilization was like so impressive. So they made it so that we were white, which is ridiculous, because in the first attempts at describing Egyptians by Herodotus, which was like one of the earliest historians that white people will like consider historians, he described Egyptians as like a woolly-haired, you know, like dark-skinned people, like pretty much called us, you know, as part of the, let's say part of Africa. So I don't know. It's a weird thing. It's old. It's complicated. There's a lot of vested interests in Egypt not being part of Africa. And a lot of Egyptians have fallen trapped to that white supremacist narrative, to that like light skin supremacy. And it's replicated multiple times because we were also colonized by Arabs and by Turks and by, you know, a specific brand of Islam, and it's still continuing today. We've been colonized by everybody. Like, so many people came through and ruled Egypt because Egyptians were not like, I guess, I don't know, but I have a theory that we were not really a fighting people. Like, we were kind of like, oh, there's a new ruler. He's from wherever. Like, whatever, cool, as long as we get bread, you know? So, yeah, we were like a culture that accepted a lot of cultures, and we got kind of fucked for it. And people came and like Egyptianized themselves that weren't Egyptian, like Greeks and stuff. That's why we had so many like Greek pharaohs or whatever. So yeah, like colorism has existed for a long time, and it's part of the reason why Egyptians might consider themselves different from Africans, and why the rest of the world might agree with that. But when you actually go to Egypt and you see Egyptians, you can see Africa, like it's there. And it's, I mean, yeah, it's a crazy thing to like even think of the Arabian Peninsula as part of Asia is pretty arbitrary. Like, it could definitely easily be part of Africa, and it was. The old map shows the Arabian Peninsula as part of Africa. So even if you were to consider Egypt Arab, which it is not, it has only been Arab for like 50 years. Then you could still consider the Arabs African. I mean, there's a lot of interchange there, but there's also slavery that made North Africa very, very mixed. So if anything, Egyptians are more African, more Western, sub-Saharan African now than they ever were before. Like something like 15% more sub-Saharan. So it just doesn't make any sense. It's all bullshit and very aggressively like constructed into the like greater systemic narrative of white supremacy and like aliens. I hate when people say that our shit is built by aliens. Like, it pisses me off so much. I'm just like, wow, like fuck you too, you know? Like, fuck you also, you because fucking asshole.
It couldn't
possibly, oh my God, yes.
It couldn't possibly have been anything other than space. It couldn't have been ancient people of color. It
couldn't have been Egyptian.
It couldn't have been, you know, Arabs who invented math and poetry. It must have been alien. Oh my
God. Right. Yes. That's another thing that is very interesting, is the feedback system of colonialism is like, you know, back in the day before colonization, the Middle East, or these countries that we group together under the umbrella term Middle East, were like places where like sexuality and gender were extremely variant, and people were like freaky in ways that we would like be shocked today, you know? And then you had all of this interaction with Europe, and them coming in and describing our people as like really like decadent and like debaucherous, you know? And then fucking us up so hard through war and colonialism, and intentionally breeding a specific kind of Islam that is vilified and then like hated all through the world, and then they like bust us up so much that we cling to this like really destructive, toxic form of Islam that then does the rest of the work. So then we colonize ourselves multiply, and then they don't have to do anything. The system just replenishes itself. It's like it's like, oh, cool, we install this like radicalized, like desperate people who have no, like, no way out, and then we, like, I don't know, we call them terrorists and for fighting back, and we don't see like the terror and the terrorism that has been ongoing and chronic and like subtle and then gaslighted because it's so subtle and built so perfectly to privilege the white man that you don't even see it anymore, and then you end up arguing between yourselves about whether or not you're oppressed. So you can't even connect with your own people because you're fighting, because you're saying, oh, but no, it's not that bad. And look what they give us and this, this, and that. And you should be grateful. And I don't know what the fuck, but it's like, and then, you know, then you can't even connect with your own people. So giving, I know I'm going through so many different topics right now, but like, I want to like give the example in belly dance, which is a constructed form of a style that Western people created that is actually a mishmash of multiple styles, mainly Egyptian baladi and some other styles like Iraqi qawliya dance. And it's for white people, really. So what happens is they become so interested in our dances, which come from a lot of risk and a lot of pain because we're not allowed to dance them. As women, it's immodest to be a dancer and to shake like that. But that's our shit, that we used to do that freely. And now to do that, we have to be named sluts and whores and risk a lot of social shunning and whatever and shaming. And then they get to take this dance and go, oh my God, this is beautiful. I feel so comfortable in my body. This is great. It's giving sexual liberation. I feel like I can be fat, I can be this and that, and it's like I feel free, and it's like great, you feel free, and we feel like trapped, and we risk death, and we risk divorce, and suicide, and mental health issues, and then we can't find our own people to teach us our own dances. So now I'm looking for a teacher, and there's just white people, man. There's just fucking white people as far as the eye can see, and I'm so happy that they're so happy, and they're finding a dance that's making them so happy, and like we're all fucking happy. So happy for you, but I'm not happy, and I don't get to see my people, and nobody talks about it, nobody cares. It's not for me anymore. It's like, it's not for me.
And appropriation happens, I think, at this intersection between demonization and fetishization, and I think belly dancing is like a perfect example of that, where it's equal parts demeaned and fetishized.
100%. And the dance is revered while the people are disrespected and considered primitive, barbaric, you know, savage is a word that's often used to slur indigenous people on the Americas, but it's definitely describing also North Africans and Africans generally. It's like, yeah, they think we're not worthy of like these lofty ideals of freedom and justice, when it's like we who gave it to them, like, you know, and then now we're suffering, and they're just kind of like, oh, you're suffering because you're inferior. Meanwhile, I'm going to take this really cool dance and this really cool style, and I'm going to fucking be superior, and I'm going to get paid more than you because I'm white, and I'm like, you like that. You think that that's a status thing. It's like, oh, a white woman, that's hot, you know? And then you, like, I went on a trip with my parents to Luxor, and there was a Egyptian belly dancer. She came in, she danced, and she had a belly. Sue her, she had a belly, and she was a belly dancer, okay? And the Egyptian men, dude, on the fucking, the whatever, they were like, they thought we were like cool and stuff, so they were like, ha, look at her belly, like, oh my God, she's so lazy, like, wow, like, she looks tired, man, she's not even dancing hard. And I'm just like, what the fuck? You're a fucking dick. I did not respond well. I didn't laugh. I was like, that's not true. She looks great. She's doing a great job. That's what we like. And I just wanted to remind him, like, hey, like, actually, this is a dance for the bigger body. This is not for skinny girls. This is not for, like, the white woman. It's just not. Like, and now you're so colonized, you can't see it. You're hating on your own people. This woman took such a risk coming up here, and she's Saidi. Saidi is like from down south Egypt. They're fucking hard. They're hard and they're patriarchal. So this woman to come dance on a ship I don't know what her life looks like, but I can imagine it's fucking hard, and she gets bullshit all day long from her own people. And white women are not having that same experience when they're belly dancing. They are not having that experience. And they get to learn from each other. They get to learn from their masters, whatever. I don't get to see my own people represented, and I don't get to learn from them.
And this is structurally across the board in America's en plus. I mean, Michelle or Marissa or Jason, I mean, I don't know which one of you wants to speak to this first, but that, you know, you can't find people who have this ancestral knowledge because they've been wiped out. What you can find is the whitewashed version, easily accessible, easy to swallow. And so I don't know which one of you wants to speak to that first. We're all just kind of shaking our heads in dismay.
I just want to say one more thing about
that. Yes, please.
Like, the athleticizing of belly dance, it's like become like a fitness trend. And like you see these like muscular ass girls, like no offense to a muscular body. I love a muscular girl. But to see like a white woman's body all perfect with no excess fat, just these fucking little perfect abs, like doing this dance and being like extremely athletic. And I'm just like, wow, you made this a circus art. Like how? Like it is the antithesis of the spirit of belly dance, which is a soft dance. Soft like cream, spilling, pouring, not hard motion, excess static, I don't know what I'm using like crazy words, but it's supposed to be soft and dala. We have a word in Arabic, dala, that is untranslatable. You cannot translate it into English because you would translate it to spoiled. And it's not spoiled. It's actually a very nice word to describe someone who's like so flirty to the point of excess, they become frothy. So that's belly dancing. It's not a fucking super like hardcore CrossFit situation. So it's weird. It's weird to see that. And I don't know how to feel about it. I'm confused. I'm mad. I know I feel mad, but I don't know why.
I know why. Well, again, I think it's what we've been talking about this whole time, where and we could say the same thing about yoga, where yoga is a holistic practice, and it you know it comes from like thousands of years of cultural exchange and wisdom that was not written down, and oral tradition and things that you can't even necessarily find in books that are so ingrained in a certain culture, and then they get turned into a fitness craze.
And then you have them on shirts that's like namaste at home.
Exactly, you know, and where namaste just becomes another, you know, cute greeting, and all of the actual meaning knowledge is taken out of it. Or like Marissa, I know that you've spoken before about the idea of spirit animals. You know, people on Twitter are like, oh, you know, Lizzo is my spirit animal. What do you have to say about that?
Lizzo actually spoke out about it.
Yes. I know she did. Bless her heart.
I think a lot of cultures have kinship towards animals and have connections towards animals. And I feel like there's certain terms that are for, you know, our cultures only. And to see people using them outside of that is, in my respect, disrespectful. And it comes from a place of privilege that doesn't have to do the work, that doesn't have, like, you know, it doesn't come from a culture that had to preserve things so hard to pass it down to us. So it's like with a lot of what goes on in New Age, and you know, hearing you speak about what goes on in belly dancing, and me thinking about my own appropriations in the past and just being like, like just grossed out. But it's because I've had to do the hard work of decolonizing. I've had to do the hard work of, you know, having and continuing to do the hard work of, you know, being accountable. And I'm still thinking about what you said about belly dancing, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like,
Can I ask what your thoughts are on it?
I know, I just like, I'm completely agreeing with you, and like, I just, you know, I like hearing other people's you know, experiences with appropriation and seeing how it's affected them, because, you know, throughout the board of being people of color, like how it affects us emotionally and how it affects us in our everyday lives. And it's hearing you talk about it, it sounded like land removal to me almost. You know, it's like, it's literally like you're taking our identity. You took the land, you took the culture, and it's a continuation of that. And it hurts.
Because I think in all of these situations, it wasn't a case of, oh, you know, the settlers showed up and then everything was cool. And then y'all's teachings just kind of faded away. Like, no, once again, it was a war. The elders were murdered.
Criminalizing.
And the same thing with Maffa, go ahead.
And no, and to this day, like, you know, saying how women are meant to feel shameful about their bodies when it's like, no, this is how our bodies were meant for this. This is how the ideal body is for this. And how it's, I think about that within my own culture as well. Like, we have such huge issues with colorism. And who is beautiful? Like, what is the standard of beauty? And why is it this now from when it used to be this? And me acknowledging my own privileges of being light skinned in my community. And it just, I'm still blown away by everything that you've said. So maybe someone else should speak.
I can talk a bit on it, because you were talking about like a lot of the lateral violence that comes from your own community. And we see so much of the lateral violence in within our own communities. It's like, in ceremony, there's a lot of skirt shaming. So you'll have like, women will be meant to wear ribbon skirts, and then you'll hear a lot of like, you'll hear a lot of teachings that make sense, but then you'll hear a lot of stuff that's just kind of like, okay, so our ceremonies are banned for like a long time until the 50s.
Until the 50s. And then the
70s.
The 70s in the US and the 50s in Canada.
And if you wanted to leave res, you had to get permission from the Indian agent to leave your res. And who are the only people that could get permission because they had to go hunt was the men. And that's just because of European patriarchal normativity, whatever. So there's been a lot of talks about how ceremony becomes male centric and how we've lost a lot of our moon ceremonies, how we've like where the women and the non-binary person have lost like their key roles in our ceremonies and our traditions. And a lot of it gets shamed and pushed back now. And it's, yeah.
That is the most hurtful part of everything. I think I can like, I can, I've developed.
Oh, I think I lost her after the word developed.
Yeah, same.
Should we give her a second? I really want to know what she's developed.
Yes.
Hopefully we'll come back to it.
It's just like the people that have hurt the most out of this are women and non-binary people. Like that's just what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping that Amanda was going to join us because I know she self-identifies as Two-Spirit, which is again another sort of term that
It's not an old term. It's a newer term.
Mm-hmm, but it's been. Go ahead.
And it's really funny because both me and Amanda are Mi'kmaq. So Mi'kmaq don't actually have a term for Two-Spirit. And that this, it came out, it's an Ojibwe, like, I think it was Ojibwe, where the term was coined because they have like specific roles for Two-Spirit. Not all communities can remember the roles or have it accessible.
And Phoenix is back. Phoenix, yeah. You said, I'm developing. Is that it? What are you developing? We're waiting.
I guess I wanted to say that, like, it's hard to be oppressed, obviously. But I think the hardest hits when it's close to your home. So, like, the people you love hurting you is always going to hurt, like, 1,000 times more than people you expect to hurt you. You know what I mean? People you've established a boundaried relationship with, you know. Whereas, like, that it's the lateral violence part that is really heartbreaking, and it comes from about, like, from the oppressed, you know, the oppressive party. But damn, it's just like, that's where, like, my focus is usually, is just like containing the pain in our communities, like holding space for that. And maybe, like, if white settlers or just settlers in general wanted to make, like, available space for other people to connect with each other, like, that would be cool. Like, to be witness is, like, also, like, a really important and, like, valuable role, to just, like, listen and witness, like, and not participate, you know. Not everything is for everyone, and, like, asking, like, a community, like, is for me, is, like, a really respectful and, like, consensual, it's just like a check-in. Like, you wouldn't, like, just touch somebody without asking.
Yeah, and back to what excuse me, what Michelle was saying earlier about two-spirited, in as Inuit, we don't have the term two-spirited, but in our language, there's no gender-specific pronouns. It was always they or them. And it's only since the European settlers came that everything went binary, and it seemed the people who were in between got pushed to the side of it being wrong and bad. We just didn't fit in anymore.
Is there no end to the absolute just, I don't even, the word destruction isn't going to cut it. Just like the colonialism and colonialist mentalities, what we've been robbed of as a contemporary culture, what could have been, I mean.
Well, this kind of, like, it's funny because this ties into what's happening now, and people always diminish and erase what Indigenous people have been saying for hundreds of years. And look what's happening now that we can't take what we need, and that we overextract. And yeah. And the thing that keeps repeating lately, especially with the COVID, is that we are the virus, and we're the virus, and we should just all get wiped out because humans are the worst thing that's for this planet. And it's like, I'm sorry, Indigenous peoples have found a sustainable way to live for, like, thousands of years until y'all showed up and pretty much caused global warming by stepping foot on North America.
Like, literally, it was all fine for, like, 20,000 years. And I'm saying this is Amy talking, I'm saying this as me, the white devil came along and fucked it all up in, like, 100 years. 20,000 years people lived in harmony with the earth, and it took us 100 to fuck it all right up. It blows my mind. I can't imagine the lack of foresight, Sorry, Marissa, can you repeat that?
I said we have amazing cultures. Like, you know, we built amazing trade systems. Like, you know, some of us did not get along with each other. Some of us did. And, you know, we had communities that flourished, and we had agricultural systems that were just, like, you know, like, mind blowing. And, you know, we had matriarchs. Like, it's just, we were ahead of everybody, and y'all kept on pooping in your water. that's how I always joke about it in order to make myself laugh, because it's not a funny thing when you really think about the truth. But that's how I think of it. It's like, you guys kept on pooping in your water. You know, you kept on killing each other. You know, you kept on taking and taking. And then when you were like, oh, well, we already took this, what's over here? You know, it just, and it was all done in a very, in the idea that it was done for the better good and the better good for white folks. So like any sort of doctrine that you read, it's always like for the benefit of the of man, and it's of a white man. And, you know, we are cast into the category of savages. You know, you come from, you know, these, like, you're hedonistic and all that. And it's like, no, our cultures are very beautiful. And, you know, we're trying to reclaim that and, you know, try to take the practices of our ancestors into the present, because our societies had benefited from them then, and we can benefit from them in the future and now.
And certainly, I mean, we know that ancient Polynesians outpaced the Portuguese and the Spanish in terms of their navigation. We also know now that, like, a burning sage, appropriation aside, actually can cleanse the air of bacteria. And the number of years of oral tradition and trial and error, and this works, and this, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, that led to these discoveries that then were just wiped out. And the idea that now they have to be dug up, refound, when they were perfect already.
This, I have to say that this is why science, or scientific, like, over-prioritizing science or whatever, can be so fascist, because it's like they science is catching up to what Indigenous people have been saying for like a really long time, but they've been discounted because their knowledge production systems haven't been like seen as science, which is so absurd. And it's like very scientific over generations, so it's even more sciencey than science. I lost my train of thought, but like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. It's so stupid.
Yeah, that because it's oral tradition, because that they didn't have the paperwork to say this is happening, it's all just been completely discounted. And the fact that, again, it took maybe 11,000 years to come up with these ancient systems that worked so well, like Marisa was talking about, the agricultural systems that were perfect and beautiful, and that they had figured out the Three Sisters, for example. You know, these are things that require trial and error for, like I'm saying, thousands of years. And the idea that settlers came and said, well, these savages need to be wiped out and have nothing to treat us, is one of the, if not the greatest tragedy, I think, of human existence. Am I being overblown? Am I talking like pandemic times? Like, maybe I'm just, you know, I'm feeling apocalyptic right now. And so I'm tracing it back to 1492.
Not even, because, sorry.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, like, I was going to say, like, going back to, like, what Michelle was talking about earlier with that couple from Quebec going to the Yukon, like, you know, this is, we've gone through so many measures to protect our cultures and to protect the knowledge. And, you know, we have to protect our elders and, you know, protect the people who do have the knowledge, because, you know, this is, it's not just a fight for, you know, people to stay healthy and to, you know, keep our community safe. It's like, this is like a fight to preserve cultures, like, again. So, like, you know, people stay home. Don't go to areas that, you know, are limited in resources. Like, don't get others sick, you know. Like, just to go back to that whole COVID talk, I just, you know, it makes me think about that, where it's like, you know, this is like the time where we need to stay put and not, you know, escape like some people do.
Mm-hmm. But my people are showing up with the smallpox blankets, like, you know, it's better for my economy if all your grandmothers die. So, I mean, in the face of that, I mean, and now looking at it, it seems like this has just been what's been going on. Again, like, for people like me who have never dealt with food insecurity or this type of, like, these very real things that are happening to you out there right now have been happening to Indigenous communities across the Americas for 500 years.
And it's hilarious because this couple ran up to the north where they have the worst food security. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm That's sure strange. Jason can talk on that one.
Can you talk about food security, Jason, please?
Oh my God, yes. How much time do we have?
As much time as you think it takes to get the point across.
I grew up very, very poor. Didn't realize it at the time because we always had food on the table, roof over our heads, and never wanted for anything. But looking back on it now, our diet consisted of meat that my father or that anybody brought into the house, and bread that was made from flour and whatnot. It was basically a meat and potato diet. And like, I didn't think about it growing up, but as I got older, it was always wondering, when's our next meal going to come in? Like, is the hunting season going to be good this year? We couldn't rely on the Hudson Bay Company first and then the Northwest Company to bring in any type of viable food. Like, everything that comes in is so overly processed that cancer rates have gone up within the communities. They say it's not because of that, but we know it is. And then where I'm from, we're on the outflow of the Churchill River. And they just put a second hydroelectric dam on the river and didn't clear cut to reduce the amount of methylmercury that was going to be leached into the water. And now my community and other people downstream are looking at having to eat poison food that will move its way up through the food chain and increase cancer rates, be more problematic with birth defects and whatnot. And they just approved the third one on the river. So food security back home is like, we always shared. Nobody went without, but like, we were poor, dirt poor. Even worse in my father's time, he used to tell me stories that he'd have to roast a piece of sealskin to chew on to extract the nutrients out of it. I guess I don't know how much nutrients is in the sealskin. And chewing, he called it kutch, but I think it's almost like a type of tar to ease his hunger pains growing up. And this was my father. Like, he passed when he was 86. So it's not that long ago. Oh. And yeah.
And what do you think your father would say if someone angrily suggested that he become vegan?
Probably would have told him to fuck off.
Yeah.
I did try going vegetarian when I was angsty in my 20s back home. But I think I made it for about like 4 hours. I think that was it. I went to the store and I was like, okay, I did a little bit of research. I was like, I need protein, but I also want to get some veg. It was summertime, so there was a few tomatoes there and potatoes, carrots, and turnip. I'm like, no, screw this. This will never work here. It's a high protein, high cholesterol diet base that I could not escape if I wanted to. I think my dad would have told him to go fuck themselves.
Right. And I mean, I mention it because I know, Michelle, you've dealt with this where...
Can I tell my vegan story?
Please.
Oh my fucking God. All right. So, because it's really funny, because this links into the last episode where we were talking. And we were talking about call-out culture. And how it's probably like when you're calling out someone who's appropriating or when you're wanting to have the hard conversation, you should call that person in privately before you call them out. Well, like, I don't know. I think it was like 2 weeks or like a week after that episode aired. So I launched a new line in collaboration with someone else. And in the photos, in the model shoot, I'm wearing a vintage fox pelt. And I actually have another story after this, which is interesting. So I was wearing a vintage fox pelt and I decided to run an Instagram ad because I got credits. And everything's because I get fucking ad credits. Like, I should just not take ad credits ever. Anyways, so I let Instagram choose my reach based on my followers. And then it ended up in all these vegans, I guess, timelines.
Go figure.
So then they all tried to call me out on my page. And then it got really, like, abusive. and they started talking about like my pets and my animals, and then I had to block a bunch of them. Like I tried to educate, like I always try to educate and call them in before like just completely canceling them. And I was like, well, I don't support mass farming because that's not very nice and it's unethically harvested, but I do source from ethical sources, indigenous harvesting, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, I don't care. Like get to the future, get to like the modern age. I don't know. It got really, really abusive. I had to block them all. That was that. And I'm like, well, I don't get what they were trying to call out. They thought they were doing good work, but in the end, they were just like harassing me.
Were they all named Karen?
They were all like all of their profile names are like Vegan John, Go Vegan something. Like, I don't fucking know.
Radical vegans. Oh, God.
Radical vegans. And I'm not, you know, I'm not going to say all vegans because we know that, like, mass farming, which was introduced to us from Europe, totally. is horrible.
Ironically, irony of ironies.
Yeah, and it's studies have actually shown that industrial farming is worse for the land than ethically harvesting animals for food source,
which is good for the land because of
it. It also makes me think about like the synthetic industry, like, and you know, synthetic leathers and synthetic like fabrics and all that, and it's like, you know, that these materials use so many chemicals and they produce so much waste, and that ends up going back into the environment and into people's water, and yet you are not okay with cultures, you know, doing nose to tail eating, reusing everything of the, like the animal. Like, you're not okay with that, but you're okay with this, like, you know, fake Doc Martin that is like polluting environments. Okay.
Or on the plant spectrum, human slavery. Like people have seen stories surfacing of, you know, like almonds, the way it hurts the bees. Like, there's so many other ecosystems that are hurt by like this mass
certainly
vegan craze.
Soybean farming. I mean, they're clear cutting, you know, acres of the rainforest for more soybeans every day. But I think that, you know, that it's all this, like, it's all culturally relative, obviously. And it's what we're saying. You can't expect Jason's father, who lives in Nunavut, to even consider veganism because it just is, it's not possible, regardless of your feelings.
Yeah, and then we get all these people.
Yeah, Marisa just said, and then all the alternatives are toxic.
Yep. But then I laugh at the people who are saying, oh, you should buy organic, you should eat organic, it's better for the environment. And then I look at them and say, well, seal is probably the most organic thing ever. It lives its life in the wild. It's ethically harvested. The meat is so nutrient-rich that it's amazing. It's sustained our people for thousands of years. And then the pelts can be used as clothing and nothing goes to waste. Like you said, like if you want organic, eat seal.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I think that weird focus on the baby seal, is it just because baby seals are so cute that they became like, there's this, it just seemed like such a weird, ill-advised campaign. You know, that these people who are using these, again, these thousands of year old techniques and using, you said nose to tail, Jason, I think was the term.
I think Marissa said that, but yeah, that's pretty much.
Yeah, that this
that's
could
like consider. Yeah, it's just, it's, you know, it's not just an indigenous practice, it's a practice that's used around the world where, you know, you use every part of the animal. And I feel like a lot of the alternatives that a lot of, like, you know, people who identify as progressive, you know, say is like, oh, this is better for the environment. Oh, this is like better for your body and like all this. And it's like, you don't think about the labor that goes behind it, illegal labor, you know, the people that are, they're fighting, you know, the messes that my government caused to have a new life. Like, they are getting paid garbage so you can eat healthy. And then you're not even thinking about, you know, the battery in your Tesla car, you know, how much water was taken off of indigenous lands to get that battery. Like, you don't even think about, like, you know, like lithium mine. You don't even think about that. You know, you only think about what you see. And what you see makes it look like you are doing good, but what you're not doing is you're not doing the research, you're not doing the work, because what you're good is doing a lot of harm towards communities that are, you know, really suffering. And it's also hurting the planet. So
yeah, if you look at like the electric car, the open, if you Google open pit lithium mines, there's like thousands of acres of land completely destroyed with a big hole in the ground with all of this runoff coming from the mines. And then you need electricity to power your car. A lot of people say, oh, hydroelectricity is amazing. It's better for the environment. It's green electricity. But then, like I said earlier, water systems become polluted and people's ways of life are destroyed. But now they can make money on it, so they're going electric.
Real talk.
It's like everything that we inherently do as indigenous peoples or people of color is radicalized. And it was funny because I was telling the story about the ad that I tried to run with the vegans attacking me. I tried to run another ad recently this winter for an indigenous artist market because I'm also an events organizer. So, hey, indigenous people, for the holidays, sell it.
Sorry.
You know what I'm getting to, eh? Mm-hmm. So indigenous people trying to assemble together and promote our lovely market, and Facebook hit me back with a thing saying, I can't post ads that involve political content and that I need to be a politician to post the ad. And I'm like, wait, what? So just because it says Creative Native or it says the word indigenous in any of the taglines, it's automatically flagged as political content. I had to put up a media shitstorm for this ad to get flagged as running. And it's just like, how many other indigenous people and artists like myself that are like, I want to get my work out there. I'm going to pay for an ad. And they're like, wait, no, you're not the prime minister. You can't do this. And that's even funny because I had my friend who was running with the NDP. So technically she is a politician and she tried to run the ad for me and it still got blocked. And I'm just like,
because your existence as an indigenous person is a political act of defiance.
Penalized anyway.
Yeah.
And with a lot of crafters in the north, they do use Facebook and Instagram to sell their products. But if you go on a site like Iqaluit Auction Bids and you look at somebody's trying to sell a sealskin parka, for example, they have to change the spelling of sealskin to use the dollar sign as the S and like a 4 for the A so that it doesn't get flagged as a seal product so that it's deemed unethical by Zuckerberg.
And the idea of Zuckerberg controlling what is decided to be ethical and unethical is terrifying. I'm going to say it. It's terrifying.
it's not even Zuckerberg because it's happening on Etsy too. So I've been on Etsy since 2006. I run something called the Montreal Etsy team in Montreal. And their policy has increasingly become more and more restrictive on Indigenous sellers, banning animal products. We can't even send porcupine quills through the border to the States and up here. If you post anything that's seal, they remove it. There was an artist who was selling on Etsy, and that was their main income. They took down the entire shop. They closed it because of the seal skin. They didn't even like send a warning. They just completely shut down the entire shop. And the only reason she got help is because our media took up the story. And if you go, because I ended up speaking with the head office, well, the Canadian office, when I was talking to them, like, why is this? And they're like, oh, they can't sell an endangered animal. I'm like, well, it's good that seals are not endangered. And then, so that's like That's the warning you get when you try to post it, is that seals are endangered animals. But when you go talk to people in their actual office, they're like, oh, international law. And I'm like, but you're an American company and it's not illegal to like sell seal in America. And why can't you just create inclusive policy to like restrict shipping areas? Like there's no leeway there. They just, nah, it's just banned. So
crazy. My friend just posted an Israeli designer who created a piece that was based on Palestinian embroidery and called it Moroccan. And then the caption said Nakba, but make it fashion. And the Nakba, maybe you don't know, is the catastrophe. It's the day that like basically Palestinians lost status to like Israel. And it's a catastrophic day. So I don't know about fashion.
But make it fashion.
Wow.
Fuck.
And was this something that was for sale?
Yes, it was like an embroidered top of a wedding vest, the Palestinian style. And it's she called it Moroccan. En plus, it's not even Moroccan, and Moroccans don't do that.
Just like all kind of wrong.
Yeah.
This was on Etsy?
I don't know. I think, I'm not sure about Etsy, but.
Oh my God. Anyways,
yeah,
yeah, that's a plethora of appropriation.
Indeed. Yeah, I did a little research earlier today, and I'm on my screen that I did the research on, so I don't know how to access it without disconnecting. I'm not.
You can share your screen, eh?
Okay, but I'll disconnect, and then everybody's internet will break. Yeah. But there was a design company in the UK, it's three letters. I can't remember the name of them now, but they've been stealing North American indigenous designs for years. Hmm. And in the Smithsonian Museum, there's a coat that a shaman actually wore. It was his personal protection and symbols that were specific to him that he earned in his journey. And this fashion company parades down the runway with a knitted version of this jacket, with the exact same symbology, exact same meanings on it, without requesting the permission of his grandchildren. Like, the jacket is not that old. So his grandchildren held all the rights to it, not to mention the cultural appropriation. And they've been fighting with them ever since. But yeah, if you Google Inuit shamanic coat used for fashion, it'll pop up. It's like the first five stories.
And for our listeners at home, I will make sure to look that up and put something in the show notes, because that's something that
I'll
be reading about. Yeah,
and
I mean,
post it in the group chat.
I don't even know what's going to happen to you if you put those symbols on and you have no fucking clue what they mean. Like, oh my God. Like, really? Yeah. Like, you're wearing, like, what are you doing? Like, you don't even know what you're inviting in. You don't know, like, what the symbols mean. Like, white Europeans who are reclaiming Norse traditions, I see them so, like, sloppy with their runes. Like, you don't know what you're putting on your body. Like,
for sure.
And the worst thing about runes nowadays is that a lot of white supremacists have claim the runes of their own. So if somebody unwittingly decides they like a rune, they put it on their body and they go somewhere and it'll be like, what up, brother? Like, welcome to the brotherhood.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know a woman who's like shy about her rune tattoos because she's like, great, now I look like a fucking white supremacist. Like, that was really not my intention. Thanks, white supremacists. Like,
well, I have a medicine wheel tattoo on my finger, and I'll show you guys on camera. It's right here for your good medicine.
Oh my God, I love it.
For those of you at home, that's on Michelle's middle finger. So yeah, here's the medicine.
It's your good medicine. And I just wanted the basic medicine wheel. And my tattoo artist was like, hey, we realize this is also a white power symbol if you take the cross. Which is, she's like, do you want the medicine wheel to be turned? And I'm like, I don't want it to be turned. It's like the original, I want it to be the original medicine wheel. So I added dots for the cardinal point, like the other, like the cross cardinal points. But it's just like, oh, people are going to think I'm a white supremacist.
Yeah, Because white supremacists ruin literally everything. Literally every single thing that's ever existed.
And even within the Norse community, there's a lot of divide there, because you'll have a lot of these white supremacists arguing that it's inherent in their Norse culture. One of my favorite articles, and I will find it so we can post on this episode, is called "There's No Place for Racists in Valhalla." And the guy goes through and basically breaks all of the misunderstandings that white supremacists seem to have about, like, racism. And but it's like, I keep thinking, like, I keep coming back to that thing, and it's like white people liking to take things and, like, just, like making up excuses for different stuff. Like, even Hitler did it. Hitler said that indigenous people, he considered them under the Aryan race because of the whole Winnie Two bullshit in Germany. Same with the French. It's like, hey, the French Celts are cool too. Like, I'm just going to take it and be like, these guys are okay. They're the whiter, like, of the other colored people.
And another thing about Hitler too, he actually admired the way that the North American governments handled the Indian problem, in quotation marks. And he kind of took that and used it as a way to handle his problems, in quotes.
It's very ironic. Do you guys know about Winnie Two, that book series in Germany, and why they have powwows over there?
Oh my God. I heard about that festival.
Yeah, me too. Why? It's, why did they do it?
It's not even a festival. Okay, so Drew Hayden is an author here, and he did a documentary where he decided to go figure out why Germans have powwows.
Yeah.
And it's basically like Disneyland over there. It's crazy. So in the birth of Germany, basically, there was an author who romanticized North America, and he created this story about Winnie Two, who's an Apache warrior who hunts buffalo, which, if you think about, like, geographically, it doesn't make sense because buffaloes weren't there anyways. Let's not even to say that, like, they're not even buffaloes in North America, it's bison. So he's this lovely Apache warrior hunting his bison, and the Germans love this story because it reminded them of, like, the old, like, Norse days and whatever. So this book was made into a TV show. It was made into musicals. You can go to, like, reenactment fairs. It's like a medieval renaissance, but, like, powwows.
Yeah. People are dressed up to the T. They all have their, like, fake clans.
Yeah, and they make all their regalia themselves, and it's, like, impeccable. It's insane.
So it's like, it's like Civil War reenactment, but, like, First Nations reenactment in
Germany? But it's all for this character, Winnie Two.
Wow.
Winnie Two is basically like Mickey Mouse for the German. Like, and if you can watch this documentary, because I love, like, because we laugh a lot. It, like, none of this is funny, but, like, if you can't laugh, like, what else do you have in life? And Drew Hayden has, like, a way to make it a bit easier to watch.
Right.
Michelle, do you ever have people come up to you and point blank look at you and say, can you tell me about your people's shamanic practices?
Oh my gosh.
There's one lady here in Montreal, I'm not going to mention any names because I can't remember her name. Every event she finds the Inuit artist there and goes up to them, and, like, if, especially if they're new to the scene, we'll go up to them and say, can you tell me about your people's shamanic ways? I really want to learn.
God.
Wow. Well,
damn, that was the first question I wrote down on my pad. I guess I'll skip that. Jason, can you tell me about your people's shamanic ways, please? I really wanted to hear about that. And, but I think, again, let's talk about this word shamanic. Who wants to jump in on this word shamanic? I feel like it's been definitely bastardized. It's not even the word.
Well, But it doesn't it come from like Russia, Siberia or something, where like they had these like religious folks and they were called like shamans, and then the word has been like misappropriated to describe like any mystical healer. It's kind of like very like orientalist in a way, like it's just like this creation, this fabrication of like what a healer or slash mystic slash guru, you know, like it's like what the fuck.
And I sort of see that that's how the word's been used, like the plastic shaman that Michelle was talking about earlier, who, you know, goes and takes a course online and then offers these ancient teachings to you from their $29.99 online course. What do we think of the word shaman? Like
if there's anything white European love is easy to say words. So like we can even see that, like friggin' Canada can even pronounce Inuit names, so they gave them dog tags. Like there's just like an example. Like I hate the word shaman. Like if you like, we all have words for medicine man or medicine person, and they're all language specific, and like you probably can't even translate it into an English language. Like we learn, like people, like we think about, like we lose, in all this, we lose the original meanings, because even when we try to like translate and come back, we'll never come back to the original meaning. There's someone I know whose spirit name is Silver Wolf, but like in her language, silver doesn't mean silver. The word is literally for the way the stars sparkle. Mm. And like, that's like where we're losing all of our language roots. Ew. I hate the word shaman. I'm just going to throw that out there. Fucking hate it.
Jumping in.
Well, yep, I do too. I think
it's so, and like it negates like effort, and it negates like, you know, history, and it negates a lot of like, you know, what it takes to actually be a healer in a community. So like the term shaman, I feel like can apply to a person that goes through a course system or goes on a retreat to like, I don't know, Costa Rica to find themselves, you know, like it doesn't signify like, you know, how much a person like had to do in order to earn this position, like culturally as well. So
or in what culture
it just kind of like encompasses like everything, and it erases people by doing so.
And it erases specific roles. So like shaman is what? Like what kind of healer? Like cultures might have multiple practices that would be considered shamanistic. So then what are we talking about here? There's no information in the word. And it doesn't even come from, it's like not endemic or whatever. It's just wild. And people can just kind of claim shamanism because of that dilution. Because of like, who claims you? Like, I don't know. You're a shaman. Practices in some shit. It's like a fusion. Fusion. That's the word that's equivalent. It's like fucking fusion. Like, what kind of fusion? What are you respecting and honoring? Like, what are the systems that are erased by your choice of the word shaman?
Okay, I'm going to throw another phrase out there, and whoever reacts most strongly to it can make the first reaction. Reconciliation is dead.
I said this on the news recently on CBC.
So does anyone want, like, for our listeners at home who have maybe even never heard this before, what does it mean? What does reconciliation is dead mean?
Reconciliation is something that the Canadian government said would be a good idea. Like, how do I even unpack that? Because I'm sure you have a lot of American listeners, and they're not even close to having anything like reconciliation we have, and that's even sadder. Like, yes. It's basically like the government's nice package saying, here's all the trauma we caused, we acknowledged it, we'll try to send you a check. Until then, be nice in reconciliation, and when you're upset and start blocking trains, then we won't say that's very reconciliation of you.
going back to the hydroelectric dam, I think we can power all of Canada with this, the amount of tears that flows out of Trudeau's eyes every time he apologizes.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So acknowledgement helps. We've been talking about this like a lot throughout this conversation of like needing people to acknowledge certain things, but it's obviously not enough. So what's the next step? Like, be it resolved, all of our listeners have acknowledged their privilege. They've unpacked their own practice. They have acknowledged the appropriation. They've taken steps to resolve. What's next?
Well, like, I think the first thing is that like the work that is being done is never over. Like, I think a lot of people treat this as though there's a finish line and as though like, you know, there's an ultimate like, okay, well, I've completed all of these steps. And I think that's like kind of like the Western idea of how people think this should work is like, there's always a system. Like, you know, there's always a beginning, there's always an end. And, you know, I completed this course. Now I go into the next. It's like, it doesn't work that way when it comes to unsettling and, you know, trying to become a better ally. Like, it's never over. The work is never over because it's collectively enough, not enough people are doing the work.
Yeah. Actually, there isn't an ally supporter toolkit that's been developed here in Montreal.
Oh, yes. That has been going around. Yeah.
There's even like a bit of appropriation in reconciliation because now you have all this work around decolonization. And then you'll hear that hot topic show up in a lot of settlers' mouths. And I'm like, well, you can't decolonize. Like you can't decolonize. We are the only ones who can do it.
Like, that's why I like to apply the term for settlers is unsettling. Because it's like you don't get to decolonize because these were things that were put onto us. Like, your ancestors put this onto us and we have to live under this to this day. Like, you don't. So the idea that you can do the same trauma work as us is not, it's not the same.
Does anybody have anything else that they really wanted to say but just never got a chance to?
Just that, not to think of it as donating, but to think of it as reparations. Yes. And to think of like, yeah, reconciliation is definitely dead, but to also be committed to being like more than an ally. But like, I've heard the term accomplice used to describe like a much more active engagement, let's say, in dismantling settler society.
Thank you. Jason, any final thoughts?
I was just thinking about how happy I was when Romeo Saganash stood up in the House of Parliament and said Justin Trudeau doesn't give a fuck about Indigenous rights. And I was so proud and happy that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll find a clip and put it in the show notes. I'm sure it's on YouTube. Yeah. And so we just have to give a fuck. We have to give a fuck. Right, I'm getting a thumbs up from Jason. Thank you, Marisa. Final thoughts. I know it's such an immense topic, and we're definitely not going to fix anybody today. But what would you like to leave? Like, if there's one most important thing that you want to leave my listeners with, who are trying to unsettle their own lives and unsettle their own systems.
Well, you have a lot of time on your hands now because we're all inside. So, you know, take this time to like read some really good academic work, or like read works by like Eve Tuck and like KW Yang. Like, you know, like there's amazing academics out there that are coming out with, you know, what unsettling looks like, what decolonizing looks like. You know, really look towards educators, support them, support their Patreon, support their GoFundMes, and you know, just like take care of yourself right now and do the work because you have all the time on your hands and like you kind of don't have an excuse to dip out at this point. So.
Thank you. Michelle, final thoughts?
Yeah. Reconciliation is dead. I don't believe it existed in the first place, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. I guess as like settlers, what you can do is like, you know, do the dirty work, write your politicians, write your policy changers, like there is power in our voices, but we need you to like actually, you know, get up and do the hard work. And it's extremely hard to get people to care about other people. But once we pass that step, then we'll figure out what we're going to do.
And we're all just trying to figure it out together. Thank you so much, Marisa, Jason, Phoenix, Michelle. I hope that this has been enlightening for our listeners. I know I had a really good time talking to all of you, and maybe we'll do one-on-ones if anybody thinks of anything that they're like, oh, I could talk about that for another half hour. We'll do another episode. Another episode of the Missing Witches podcast dedicated. Thank you so much. Like, I really just can't express how grateful I am that you've given me your time here today. And I really hope that our listeners get something out of this and are encouraged to unsettle and shake up and fuck up whatever fucking spiritual system that has told them that they need to buy something or steal something or take something or that they're entitled to something. Hopefully we can unsettle all of those notions if we keep talking to each other. Again, I'm just so grateful that you all came to hang out with me today in all of my utter loneliness and solitude. Wish you all health and happiness and safety and security. And again, if you have anything else to say, hit me up and I'll put you back on the show anytime, any one of you, anytime. So much love. Thank you again so much, everybody. And please be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nakomi.
Thank you.
Bye. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
You must be a witch.